I hope you can hear me. I've got this mobile mic because, unlike Cole, I don't read my text. I'm also grateful that he's given you a nice Miranda warning about your rights, right, so that you can avoid the camera. And I'm particularly grateful that he gave you a warning about civility, too. So hold your projectiles and we'll have a good conversation today. I'm grateful for the opportunity to be with you. My task is really to introduce the idea of why religious freedom is important to us and what matters to us. And I think to begin with, I'll ask you to pull out your phone or your iPad or a piece of paper and a pencil. I'm going to ask you some questions. And just note for yourself the answers to these questions. Who are you? How do you define yourself? How do you interact with others around you? What is most important to you? These questions go to who you are as an individual. And we live in a country, I think I need to say right off the bat, that we live in a country, most of us, where we can answer those questions and our answers can be different from one another. And that's a significant benefit. There are places in the world where it's harder to define ourselves in an individual way. But all of these questions go to who we are as individuals, to our core beliefs and our core identity. And it's from our beliefs and our identity that we do a lot of things. We say what we say based on what we believe. We associate with others. Often we choose to associate with friends or colleagues and associates, or we assemble in churches and in public institutions with people who share our ideals. Who we are dictates what we do, how we behave, how we act, and even what we like, what we shop for, what we choose to do on our spare time. All of these things come out of who we are. And in our country, we have rights that protect those aspects. So in terms of being able to say what we want to say, we have protections of free speech. We also have protections of the freedom to associate and to assemble with other people. We have free press that protects us. We have other rules like non-discrimination and a whole host of other statutes and regulations that protect us in our behaviors and in our so that we can live out our lives in a way that's meaningful in our society. So if we have all of those protections, why do we need religious freedom? And what's it for? And the simple answer to that question is that religious freedom protects us at our core. It protects us to be able to form and hold beliefs that are important to us, and really to protect us as individuals with our own identity. And so to state this other ways, religious freedom protects our ability to define ourselves individually and collectively with others, and then speak and act out of what we believe. If our beliefs or our identity are attacked or narrowed or constricted in any way, then these other aspects, how we manifest ourselves, how we live, those are shaken as well. Constrictions can come in a lot of ways. They can come by government regulations. Many parts of the world have severe limitations on the freedom of religion or belief. A Pew study found, and I think these numbers are even escalated in a recent study, but more than 75% of the world's population live in countries where the freedom of conscience is severely limited. And that's 86% of the 143 largest countries. Restrictions on our beliefs and identity can also come from social pressures. And sometimes those are indirect, and sometimes they manifest in other forms of violence that are not necessarily government-sponsored or initiated. But they're just as real in terms of limiting our ability to define ourselves in the way that God dictates to our heart. I learned this when I was a seventh grader because I had a crush on a girl named Regina. And I really wanted Regina to be able to like me back. And there was about anything I would have done to force her to like me back. But what would be the consequence of my telling Regina or compelling her or pinning her up against the wall and say, you gotta like me? It doesn't work, right? Light love, beliefs can't be forced or they're not authentic. The only way we can truly identify or define ourselves and our identity, the way we connect with other people in a really authentic way, is for us to be able to freely choose those beliefs. Otherwise, they're forced. The European Court of Human Rights said this about religious freedom and its importance in our society. There are many other statements about its importance, but this is one I particularly like because it's from a body that's significant. You'll see, I think, why I think it's great. In its religious dimension, religious liberty is one of the most vital elements that go to the makeup, the identity of believers and their conception of life. So it's important to people of faith. But it is also a precious asset for those, for atheists, agnostics, skeptics, and the unconcerned. Why is it important to both religious and non-religious? The pluralism indissociable from a democratic society, which has been dearly won over the centuries, depends on it. That's a complicated way of saying that our very democracy depends on pluralism. It depends on having a range of ideas. It depends on having not just what's politically correct, or not just traditional values, or not just your way of thinking or my way of thinking. It depends on having a spectrum of ideas that we can draw from to form our beliefs and our identity. And it works like this. So if we go back to our model here, our graph, we derive our beliefs from a marketplace of ideas. So we choose from a whole range of different things. These boxes can represent your faith, our faith. It can represent different lifestyles. It can represent different philosophies, but they're all different worldviews. When we're born, we have a lot to learn. We come perhaps ingrained with certain fundamental ideas and things that resonate with us. But they give voice or as we select and as we choose how we're going to define ourselves and what truth we follow. But if society, through government regulation or through indirect social pressures, eliminates certain of these ideas as intolerable in some ways, then it shrinks our marketplace. It shrinks the universe from which we can choose and believe, and it then colors our beliefs and identity because it constrains them. If you're like me, I'm not a big shopper, but I do like to be able to have choices. And so this is just an analogy here. If you're going off and you need to buy the things that you need for a day or a week or a month, it's really great to go to a supermarket because of the many choices they offer, or a mall. So here we have a strip mall, and we've got the drugstore and the Polish deli and a shoe store and a couple of other stores. But if these stores were closed, and we had to buy everything from the Polish deli and the shoe store, which looks like it's bankrupt, we wouldn't have very many choices, and soon we'd all be wearing the same things or eating the same foods, and life would not be very interesting. The point, then, is exactly what the European Court of Human Rights summarized. It's essential for us in a democracy to make sure that we have a robust and open and civil marketplace of ideas from which we can choose and then define our own identity and live out our lives in ways that are responsible and respectful of others. In other words, religious freedom is the architecture that gives many diverse groups a space to coexist. It's the essence of democracy. So fundamentally, that's why religious freedom is important. It's important for us individually to define who we are, and it's important for our society because it gives us a range of choices from which to choose and develop the best society we can. Let me just summarize with three key points. First, without religious freedom, all rights suffer. Religious freedom applies to both the religious and non-religious views. And it's essential for there to be fairness for all. You see that on the taglines for the conference here, the signage. But it's really important. It can't be selfish. It can't protect just my faith, but it needs to protect your faith and all faiths and no faiths. To claim it for ourselves, we need to afford it to others. And just to emphasize for those of us who are members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, this is something that our leaders have emphasized repeatedly recently. So since 2010, my count is that there have been at least 8 conference talks directly addressing religious freedom and this concept here. To emphasize just one, in April, Elder Hales said this: religious freedom is essential to our spiritual life and our very salvation. And then he called on all of us to become engaged, and he says, brothers and sisters, we are responsible to safeguard these sacred freedoms and rights for ourselves and our posterity. And that's true because in order for us to be able to live our life in a meaningful way, our Father in heaven, and when we came to earth, gave us the great gift of agency, or in other words, the right to choose our own course. President Monson said, next to the bestowal of life itself, the right to direct that life is God's greatest gift to man. Only when we can choose from a range of options is that choice authentic. We need to have many choices in order to be able to exercise that. And so that's why our Father in heaven gives Satan free rein to tempt us in lots of ways. We encounter opposition so that we can choose our course. And that choice to follow God is faith. Faith is essential in order to access the Savior's gift of grace to each of us. For this reason, the brethren and Elder Oakes, Elder Holland, Elder Christofferson, and Sister Marriott, in a news conference in January of this year before announcing their support for non-discrimination ordinance in Utah, emphasized these very points and called for fairness for all. And it really stems from a passage in the Doctrine and Covenants where prophetic direction dictated why Mormons care so deeply about religious freedom. That civil magistrate should restrain crime but never control conscience, should punish guilt but never suppress the freedom of the soul. That's a background, friends, of why religious freedom matters to us as a democracy. It also covers, I think briefly, why it matters to those of us of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and to people of all faith, because the concepts are similar in many, many other teachings. And I just want to recap some of these things with this short video. The video is broken into 3 parts. First of all, you'll hear a lot of questions asking what is religious freedom, and then you'll see some statements from leaders of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and then talks a little bit about what we can do as individuals to help promote and preserve religious freedom.
So you don't have an opinion about freedom of religion?
No opinion?
Tell me.
Of course I have an opinion. Religious freedom means to me that you can worship a yellow dog if that's what you so desire.
You have that right as long as you're not trying to hurt other people in doing it.
Religious groups decide for themselves what their followers should be doing.
Freedom of religion is not freedom from religion.
People want
voices silenced that are not in agreement with theirs, but they don't want their own voice silenced.
We have to respect everybody, culture, religion, opinion.
If there is a more foundational issue relative to this country, I don't know what it is.
There is a battle over the meaning of that freedom. The contest is of eternal importance, and it is your generation that must understand the issues and make the efforts to prevail.
Religious freedom is the right to practice your faith, to have a faith, and to manifest it publicly and in private.
It's also the right to act and to interact with people of different faiths in a way that's consistent with your religious convictions.
People can make it sound very persuasive that, well, as long as you can believe what you want, then the rest of it doesn't really matter. But if you can't manifest your beliefs, then they lose a great deal of their meaning.
Freedom of conscience is the right to not be forced to do something that violates the truth that God has spoken to your heart. And so it's that freedom of conscience that undergirds this freedom of religion.
I think practicing what we preach is the second priority. So not criticizing other religions, not making fun of other religions, teaching your children to respect other religions, learning about your friends' religious beliefs, and then doing something.
We could go to the internet, we could go to the library, we could get engaged and involved in a local interfaith organization. You feel the brotherhood and you feel the common cause from all the different people, and you feel that we are all children of God.
You don't have to have any special kind of training. All it takes is an interest and a willingness to speak up and be involved.
In the 21st century, we cannot flee any longer. We're going to have to fight for laws and circumstances and environments that allow the free exercise of religion and our franchise in it.
I'm involved in nonprofit work and I'm currently a student.
I'm chamber board member for Leavenworth, Washington.
The Interfaith Council in Whatcom County, Washington.
Children's Community Choir.
The Fellowship of Christian Athletes.
I'm part of the food pantry in our community.
I'm president of the Latino Student Association of my school.
On Twitter, I get on and I share the things that I deeply care about.
We don't know when or where the issue is going to come up. There's no way to anticipate that. The Lord knows, and He's going to help us be in the position to make a difference.
My challenge today is that you join with people of all faiths who feel accountable to God in defending religious freedom so it can be a beacon for morality. We caution you to be civil and responsible as you defend religious liberty and moral values. We ask that you do this on the internet and in your personal interactions in the neighborhoods and communities where you live. Be an active participant, not a silent observer.
So hopefully that just gives an emphasis, I guess, to the conversations that we're going to be having today. We're going to have in the workshops and in the discussions that are follow me, lots more discussion about what it means to become involved and what religious freedom means to us on a practical level and what those different issues are that are emerging today, both in our own community and then even internationally. There are many issues that are arising. I want to begin, though, by saying that here we have a high degree of freedom. But even here in the United States and in Canada and in Western Europe, where these freedoms have been most developed, they're under pressure. And so for the next few minutes, I'd like to just introduce what some of those pressures are. And first of all, this graph from the Pew Forum, Pew Research Center's Forum on Religion and Public Life, illustrates the trends that what they've done is they've measured restrictions on religious freedom, both government restrictions and social restrictions. This chart focuses on government restrictions on religious freedom, and it measures it by region of the world. And it's beginning with the most restrictive region, the Middle East and North Africa. You'll see that they that there are significantly more restrictions there than there are in the Americas, for example, which is the lowest restriction. What this graph also shows is the pattern of movement over a five-year period. So the darker line and dot is the current level of restriction. The lighter line and dot that's just underneath that that range is the restriction level, liberal restrictions about 5 years ago. So for example, with Middle East and North Africa, the current score is 5.6, but a few years ago it was 5.2, which shows that the level of restrictions, and this is mainly measured in terms of violence or regulations that are restrictive on religious freedom, that's increasing. And the same pattern is shown in other areas. So Europe, for example, the current score is 2.3. A few years ago, it was 1.8, which is a rather significant increase. There are some areas where it's not changing very much at all, like Asia Pacific. In America, we're seeing a slight increase as well. So the current score is 1.2. Before that, it was 1.1. So I think the main message here is that, first of all, we enjoy a significant degree of religious freedom, which we need to preserve. But we have been warned by Elder Perry, who said this just before he passed away, in many countries, including the United States, religious freedom is slowly and dangerously eroding. So in the spirit of wanting to predict or assess what kinds of questions we are likely to face in the future, I'm going to just run through some scenarios and some things that we see as trends that are likely to come up. And many of these are coming from cases that have been decided by the courts in the United States and Canada over the last little bit. And these same kinds of issues are showing themselves in other parts of the world too, but we're focusing mainly for our purposes today on North America. For individuals, the first question that we need to ask is, will religious viewpoints be suppressed in the public square and other places where people live out their lives? That's a serious question, especially with the advent of other competing rights, including the same-sex marriage decision that was recently handed down. There is a serious question of whether a religious viewpoint is as welcome in the public square as a viewpoint that's contrary to that and in favor of same-sex relationships, for as one example among many. Another question to we ask is parents teaching children. Will parents of school children be able to ensure that their religious values aren't undermined through classroom instruction or intimidation? There have been cases where schools' curriculum or school teachers are instructed to present, to teach our children in ways that parents may find problematic. Can parents have a voice in that instruction? The workplace. Will employees be able to maintain their religious identity in the workplace and be reasonably accommodated when work and religious duties conflict? You may be aware of a United States Supreme Court decision that was handed down just recently involving this young woman who applied to work at Abercrombie and Fitch and was rejected because she wore a headscarf. The court ruled that she was entitled to be able to work there, but the question remains here in this country and especially in other countries whether people can manifest their religious beliefs in their clothing and especially if they're employed by the government. That's also a big question about Saturday or Sunday working rules for people who have a day of worship. Professional credentials. And this is something that's, there are actually a number of cases on this topic. Will professionals lose or be denied licensing for expressing religious views or declining to provide services that are available elsewhere but that are at odds with their belief? So, for example, this is the pharmacist who declines to dispense abortion-inducing drugs. or the physician who declines to artificial insemination in a same-sex marriage couple, or a sociology student studying social work who is denied or kicked out of her professional program because she doesn't want to counsel people of alternative lifestyles, that it's an acceptable way of life. These are actual cases, and we need to confront this issue as a society. Will family and religiously oriented businesses be able to maintain their values in the face of anti-discrimination laws? You're aware of the Hobby Lobby decision by the United States Supreme Court, where Hobby Lobby declined to provide to pay for contraceptives as part of its employee benefit plan for its employees because that violated the religious beliefs of the owners of this of Hobby Lobby, a family-owned business, whose evangelical teachings concluded that that was inconsistent and they wouldn't do that. The Supreme Court upheld Hobby Lobby's ability to decline to provide those benefits to their employees. College campuses. Will campus students groups be able to select their own leaders and express religious message? This comes out of a case from a couple of years ago involving the Christian Legal Society at the University of California, Hastings, where the Christian Legal Society required its student members to sign a pledge and an honor code of sorts that to belong to the club, you need to affirm a particular, a chaste lifestyle. And the college said that was inappropriate and banned the club from campus. They sued and it went to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court ruled actually in favor of the college and said that the college could adopt an all-comers policy, which meant that anyone could participate in any club and not be excluded. As a result of that, many Christian or faith-based clubs have been excluded from campuses and universities that adopted a similar all-comers policy, including pictured here, Vanderbilt University, for example. We confront that in our church with the LDS Student Association. Freedom from retaliation. Will those who voice beliefs be retaliated against? This is a picture of the former CEO of Mozilla. You may have heard about him in the news. His brief tenure of as CEO of Mozilla was cut short because it was disclosed that he contributed to Prop 8 in California, and he was summarily terminated. Questions for religious organizations are similar. Will churches continue to have the right to employ people that affirm and live the church's belief? Will they be forced to provide employment benefits that contradict their beliefs? We'll hear later about the Hosanna Tabor case, in which a religious-based school terminated the employment of a minister teacher. That case went to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court ruled that the school was able to decide whether to employ a minister because the minister is the lifeblood of the church. And dictating who teaches the doctrine or the beliefs of the school then of the church dictates the church and colors those things. You know, so that was a good outcome, a fantastic outcome for religious liberty. Private property. Will churches be able to build and maintain houses of worship and other facilities? Will they be able to preserve the religiously important properties for activities that are consistent with religious beliefs? Religious institutions have a hard time around the country building and maintaining their chapels because local land use boards often make those decisions based on local politics or aesthetic criteria, which may or may not be welcoming to churches. Also, churches' use of the tax exemptions have been eliminated for churches who use property in what are perceived to be discriminatory ways. And then the tax-exempt status of religious organizations themselves? Will churches and schools that affirm the traditional definition of marriage lose their tax-exempt status? Will donors' contributions be tax-deductible? This is a real question that's being posed today. Will religious organizations be able to participate on equal terms with other nonprofit organizations in government programs and the use of government facilities and properties? And then finally, will religious schools be able to maintain their religious values and standards while also retaining their accreditation and the ability to participate in federal educational and research grants? There's just as an example of this, the Obama administration recently extended an executive order that's been on the books for a number of decades that says that anyone who enters a federal contract or receives money from the government has to agree to non-discrimination policies as a condition to receiving the benefits of that of the financial grant or contract, which is a significant source of research dollars for universities, for example. Let me just add one that's not on the slide, but that's just the obvious point that will communities be able to have public celebrations of religious holidays? So prayer at the beginning of a legislative session, or statements of "In God We Trust." Currently, those things are allowed under the theory that they no longer have any religious meaning. But the question will continue to percolate of whether those things are allowed. I just want to conclude going back to Elder Hale's conference talk from April 2015 and his invitation for all of us to become involved. He said, "Don't walk, run. Run to receive the blessings of agency by following the Holy Ghost and exercising freedoms God has given to us to do His will." And specifically, he said, "Become involved, join with others, work side by side to protect religious freedom, and above all, be examples of the believer." And I think we have a little bit of time for questions, if I'm not right. So if you have any questions, it looks like we have one up here.
We have the microphones here.
So we'll send mics up. So just hold for a second while the mic gets to you.
I'm interested in how we, well, I guess I have a concern with the marketplace of ideas sort of justification for religious freedom, which seems to lend itself towards a kind of relativism of ideas. If we see religious freedom and democracy as ideas within this marketplace that clearly we believe, you know, societies probably preferably should select, I mean, how do we explain that there are in fact some ideas and values that are just better than others, or at least preferable, or that our society has chosen to advance, that, you know, therefore cause us to want to eliminate incompatible or threatening ideas within this marketplace?
I think that's a great question. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Good question. What is the marketplace, and are there limits to it? And of course there, you know, we have a long tradition, and every society has a tradition that it's built in some ways on certain ideals and culture. And that's an important part of the heritage of the communities. The reality, though, is that the world is becoming increasingly flat. And so it's a luxury that we don't have as much today as we did 50 or 100 years ago, where the culture was pretty homogenous. And so you have lots of different ideas that are being presented, and you have people of different races, different cultures, different religious ideals, and questions of what's better are difficult for a society to answer, because if we start to make value judgments based on what the best is, then that can be a fickle judgment that can be skewed by changing political landscapes. And soon, if we're cutting out certain views because we don't like them, then actually the reality is we might be next.
So why is religious freedom better than theocracy? Or, I mean, like, that's what this is my conflict, is like, okay, this is, I mean, so pluralism itself is an idea within a marketplace of ideas. I mean, do you understand my?
Yeah, let me take a shot at this. Fundamental problem here is that there are multiple ideas, and the question is, whose ideas get empowered? There is a strong risk that if you authorize government institutions to back one idea or another, they will choose the wrong one. I think there's just an incredibly high likelihood of that. I think one of the other things I would say, though, from practical experience, I think I as a law student, I didn't necessarily understand this, but I've spent a lot of time in public hearings, in public settings. And one of the realities is, if you listen to people, the ideas that come out are better than what you start with. I don't know that we have pure access to the very best. It may be part of life in the mortal situation. But I think one of the reasons religious freedom is so important is that it protects not only the possibility of, it protects not only different ideas, but it protects the seedbed institutions that make it possible to frame ideas and to frame better visions. People are going to have freedom to choose what the different outcomes will be. But I think the experience of the last 200 years was that the American experiment was right, that you come closer to something really good if you protect people's rights to freedom of religion or belief. This is not a commitment to relativism. It's a commitment that different people, it is a recognition that different people will see truth differently, and that capacity to seek and strive after truth is vital, and that we are all better off if we let people follow that, their promptings of conscience as they see it.
So there's a question right in front of the prior person.
I think just building on what he was just saying, I think to continue that out, and I have a further question on that is, so what do you do with a philosophy then, like, for instance, communism, which would not, so if that's in the marketplace, and it is, but if it were in power, eliminates other possibilities in the marketplace, and therefore, I think, possibly in a situation like we have in America, would not be considered an equal ideal or one that we would necessarily want to see rise up and have a lot of power, because that runs counter to religious freedom and it runs counter to a financial free marketplace. So how do you in protecting these different ideas, obviously not all of them are equal in that they won't respect the equality of other ideas.
This is a classic problem in liberal theory, because it was recognized by Locke, it comes down to the present. One of the ways it's been characterized is the problem of militant democracy. So what do you do when you have a Hitler who is going to come in and use elections one time to abolish elections? It's a problem all over the Middle East. There have to be some limits on what's permissible. But what we have found, I mean, at the time of Locke, he thought, well, you should tolerate all but the intolerant. But the intolerant, in his view, included Catholics, atheists, probably Muslims, and maybe Jews. This left only Protestants. I think the basic principle is right that there have to be some limits, but we have learned through experience that the limits can be fairly broad. And if you have open discourse, if you have a free society, the more extreme views tend to be self-defeating. I've spent much of the last weekend working on a draft law in Vietnam where you see the opposite, and it's clear that if you have a government that is committed to controlling every aspect of religious life, you will have problems. So I think it's vital that we fight for these things. There are going to be limits, but my sense is one of the wonderful things about American society is we can have fairly robust limits. But it depends on having all kinds of inputs, and not some of the more valuable inputs not quieting themselves and engaging in self-censorship. That's part of the reason it's so important to have a lot of people finding effective ways to encourage what they think is best. If we lose that striving, if we lose a lot of people striving, if people become apathetic, then you have no positive inputs going into the system and the negative inputs can overwhelm.
I just want to agree 100% with that. And it's really that all of this is trying to feed into a democracy, right? A democracy is the best scenario for allowing there to be that dialogue, the compromises that come out of it, that benefit for society. And so as long as we preserve that democracy, then it works. If there are, like communism or something that comes in and gains steam and limits it, then you're right back to the point of that cutting away how we define ourselves through our beliefs and our individuality.
Thank you. On a perhaps more practical side, the recent Supreme Court decision has raised a number of questions as to the extension of services and rights or the use of a facility for an act or practice that one disagrees with philosophically or religiously. What are the current limits or your perception of the current limits on whether someone can or should decline to provide services, decline to provide a facility, and object to a certain kind of activity in the marketplace?
That's a great question, and I think there are going to be whole sessions devoted to that question today and tomorrow and Wednesday. So in some ways, I want to defer some of that to those discussions because the question is really nuanced right now. It's a shifting sands. A lot of those questions are not resolved, but questions of whether a religion can use its property only for things that are religiously important or consistent with its belief, for example, those are, the current law is that it can do that, but if it opens up a facility like a wedding chapel for others and then discriminates, then it puts itself in a problem. So if it uses it only for its own use, then it's a lot more secure than, for example, if it operates as a nonprofit business or a commercial business, and then it's restricted to other people. So that gives you an example of one of the lines that can be drawn. And the same on a personal sphere as a professional declining to provide services to some. Those are sometimes dictated by state law. Some states have laws against discrimination that apply to private businesses. And so it really depends on the law of the state where you live and practice.
This is obviously a complicated question because we have the public accommodation rules coming from racial civil rights issues in the background. And I think that the challenge here, really going ahead, and it's one of the things we're thinking about, is how does one articulate some lines? Because this, by the way, is one of the areas that was not part of the Utah Compromise, and it wasn't in part because it was difficult. And there agreement could be reached in some other areas, but there are harder cases here. I think part of it is there is a sense that if people enter into commerce, they shouldn't be engaging in discrimination. On the other hand, the mere fact that you open a business does not mean you have to give up your rights of conscience. I worry a lot that we've had a world in which people have been increasingly arguing that religion should check its religious beliefs at the door and entering into the public arena in the political sphere. If we're also asked to check our religious beliefs when we enter into the commercial sphere, that's a big problem. But at the same time, people have a right not to be discriminated against. And so how to sort this out? One of the things I've been intrigued by is the argument that in some of these cases, if you've got an expressive, if you've got an expressive right, and that this might address the wedding cake cases, the photography cases, the professional cases, then there's a stronger interest in having an exemption from normal public accommodation rules. But the, as Matt says, these are cases that are very much being litigated. A lot of them have been lost recently. And I think much more thought is needed. Yeah, there was, you know, just can you wait for me?
It's my understanding, and I could be wrong, that BYU not too long ago denied exemptions to its beard to its no beard policy based on religious grounds. How do you feel about, if I'm correct, did you agree with that position, or how do you feel about that? How does that relate to what we're addressing here in terms of affording others their right to practice their religion when we demand that right? And it appears in that case that maybe the Y made a mistake. Do you agree or not?
I have to admit, I travel too much, so I don't know what actually happened. Does somebody know? I have the sense that that one got overturned, but does anyone know?
I know.
Yeah.
Historically, there have been three exceptions to the no beard policy. One is for theatrical, and also for health, and then and from time to time for other religions. And that policy was made formal, I think, January, February of 2015.
So that, in effect, overruled whatever that other decision was, right?
Or, so now or there's a formal policy where there's a procedure where you can wear a beard if you fall within one of those three exceptions.
So I'm glad I can agree with that policy.
I'm sorry, one of those exceptions now is faith-based belief?
Yeah. Yeah. Oops, let's see. Want to bring it down here?
In the recent discussions for the Supreme Court decision, I believe that Judge Alito asked the U.S. attorney whether this decision to legalize gay marriage would affect religious universities. And the answer from the U.S. attorney was a resounding yes, it will affect religious universities. What do you see happening, and what challenges are we going to face? I am aware of a case in Canada where a law school may be or is denied accreditation based on their religious standards.
Well, I think this is certainly a big risk and a big issue. I mean, I'm not sure whether the Alito colloquy was about education or tax-exempt status, but could be the same issue for both. I think it will. One of the issues is going to be how this spreads out into areas where you have not just the church itself, but religiously affiliated organizations that may be very much bound by the same conscientious constraints, and and yet we'll come up against these anti-discrimination rules on the other side. As someone pointed out, one of the difficulties is that a court that can sort of significantly broaden the way substantive due process is applied can also reshape religious liberty norms, especially since there have always been exceptions to religious liberty norms, and compelling or fundamental interests have an easier time overriding. So I mean, this is the drama that lies ahead. On the Trinity Western case, the Canadian case, there has been one court that has decided in their favor. There was a decision last week that in Ottawa, in Ontario, the biggest province, that they lost. There have been one or two others that they've lost. The issue is, because they have an honor code, very much like BYU's, the idea is that they are training people to believe in discrimination, and therefore they should not even be eligible to take bar exams or to be considered for the bar. Therefore, I mean, they can have a law school, but it will not be accredited, will not be able to function. And I think this is a really severe problem. I was on our faculty when we were going through this accreditation issue here. Fortunately, for us and for many other religiously affiliated law schools and universities in general, the tradition of religiously affiliated education in our country was strong. It's not strong in Canada. And Trinity Western, I was with the dean a week ago, they're very worried.
I'll just add that it's the position of the Obama administration that there ought not to be exceptions to non-discrimination rules for religious affiliated universities and for other organizations that have conscience. And that we saw that play out in Hosanna Tabor. We saw that play out in other cases. That's not something that's been decided. So this same-sex marriage decision does not speak to that issue. And in fact, the court came out the other way in the Hosanna Tabor case. So that's something that's yet to be decided. But it's very much where the Obama administration is headed.
Well, we're out of time. There will be many opportunities for more questions. We have one of these impossibly short 15-minute breaks, have intense discussions with someone next door for 2 or 3 minutes, and get back here, and we'll start at 10:30.